Hey everyone, what's going on? We're back for another podcast of Pedaling Forward. To reintroduce myself, I'm Rachel, and today Bristol and I are having on Alexis Latham. She's a writer who writes about her advocacy work that she does with the Inuit community in Canada.
So in this episode, Alexis talks about her time with the Inuit community, as Rachel was saying, and things that she learned about the Inuit community. A lot of it revolving around hydropower and the disruptive and destructive impacts that it had on their community and the natural environment. We also talk a little bit about regenerative agriculture at the end, which I think is pretty cool. So yeah, I hope y'all enjoy this episode, and let's jump into it.
So Alexis, introduce yourself. Tell us a little about your background and how you became involved in advocacy work.
My name is Alexis Latham. I want to thank you both for having me on this program today. It's a great honor. This is an important topic we're going to talk about that doesn't get enough attention in our area. So I'm really happy to be here. I've lived in Vermont for a little over 20 years. I live in Richmond, and I'm a writer and a writing teacher and an activist. And my activism really started when I moved to Vermont in the mid-90s. It was at the time when the James Bay campaign was very important in Vermont, because Vermont was in the process of getting ready to sign a contract with Hydro-Québec to supply a major portion of its energy for the next 30 years. So there was a lot of debate and controversy about whether or not Vermont should sign that contract. And it was a time when the Cree people were coming down from James Bay, in what we know of as Quebec, to try to get support among people in the northeastern United States not to buy energy from Hydro-Québec, because Hydro-Québec was planning his massive, massive dam complex to augment the already massive dam complex that they had already built on Cree land, which had had devastating impacts on the Cree. So all this was going on at the time, and it was a time in my life when I was in transition, and I was just starting to get involved with a group called the Native Forest Network, which was working out of the Peace and Justice Center. They were very involved in the James Bay campaign. So the Cree actually had success with that campaign, and New York State decided not to sign a major contract with Hydro-Québec. And soon after that, the province of Quebec decided to cancel its massive project for James Bay. But they also had, at the same time, this other dam project that they were planning in their eastern part of what we call Quebec, which is on the Inuit land, which they call Nitassana. So the Inuit members of the Inuit community came down to Vermont around that time. And what they were seeking was the same kind of support that people all around New England had given to the Cree, to support them in their opposition to the project that was going to be built on one of their important rivers. And it was called the SM3 project, which was slated for the St. Margaret River and was also going to involve harnessing the headwaters of the Moisey River, which is the most important pristine salmon river that they still relied on, very important to their culture, was every year fishing from the Moisey River. It was in response to that request for support that I became involved. And I made a trip up with a few, actually, University of Vermont students asked me to go up with them to meet with this community, because I had some French language skills. And whereas interesting that the Cree were, because of the missionaries that had worked in their communities, had taught them to speak English. So even though they're in Quebec, their second language was actually English, but for the Inuit, their second language was French. And it's important to note that the first language is their own language, the Inuit language, which was still very much spoken in their communities. So it was quite an extraordinary experience for me to just, at that time, I really knew nothing about First Nation in Canada. I knew very little about Canada or hydropower. So it was really an initiation for me into what became a focus for me for many, many years. So going up that first time, just to give you an idea of the geography of what we're talking about here is there is a road that follows along the north shore of the St. Lawrence River that goes, it's essentially going east, but sort of going northeast all along. So you pass through Quebec City and then you keep going, and there's some sort of very old French-Canadian fishing villages that you pass through, and you get to the Saguenay Ford, which is an absolutely magnificent place, and you cross over on a ferry. And once you make that crossing, you really are in Natasinan, which is the Innu homeland. And it extends all across the eastern part along the Atlantic seaboard, all the way up into northern Labrador. And so as you travel up this road, you're essentially crossing river after river. And these are the rivers, these were some of the best sites for hydroelectric projects on the continent, really. They, you know, because what makes a good site for a dam is a combination of vertical drop and the volume of water you have. So where you have big rivers which crash down over major waterfalls, those are the perfect sites. And that's what you have. It's a very mountainous region along the Atlantic coast there. And you have this whole series of these major rivers which come crashing down from the mountains in these big waterfalls, and then they empty out into the Gulf of St. Lawrence and the Atlantic. So it was beginning in about the 1940s that Hydro-Québec started damming those rivers, starting in the Saguenay region and then moving up. They were at the St. Margaret River about the time when I joined in. And since then, they have also dammed the La Romaine River, which is moving further up. They have more proposed, there's still other rivers that they have slated to dam up. And then once you get up into Labrador, it's not, Hydro-Québec is involved, but it's the province of Newfoundland, which is damming the rivers up there. And well, that's a lot of information, but
no, that's
I just wanted to give you a sense of the geography and where we are. And I want to also just clarify that the Innu, we're talking about the Innu and not the Inuit. They are very different. Their names are the name is similar, but they're entirely different cultures and they speak entirely different languages. But there is a point where when you get into the northern part of Labrador and also the northern part of Quebec, where there is overlap. And so the Inuit, there are Inuit communities also who are impacted by these hydro projects, but it was primarily the Innu that I have done my work with. And but more recently, over the Muskrat Falls project, that a lot of the activism and the opposition coming around that project in Labrador has been coming from Inuit communities, kind of a mixture of the different Indigenous communities who are affected by that project.
So can you tell us a little bit about the Innu culture?
Or just like your time with the Innu community, like what you did there, what you learned, anything like that?
Yeah, essential to the culture and the way of life was really that they traveled the rivers. So to understand the impact of what these dams meant, you need to understand that the whole way of life revolved around traveling the rivers. Mm-hmm. So because of the extreme seasons up there, the way of life was of course seasonal. And, you know, the industrialization and the interference by the government into the lives of First Nations peoples in the northern part of Canada didn't really intensify after the Second World War, when there suddenly became an interest in extracting all these resources. So that meant there was a major push towards cutting down the forests, building pulp mills, punching roads in, building dams, extracting minerals, and so on and so forth. And at the same time that this happened, there was also these policies of compulsory schooling and sending the children to these residential schools. And it was all part of a way of getting this pattern of movement on the land. and this way of life to come to an end so that the First Nations peoples were, you know, became sedentary and they became confined to the communities on the reserves. But I'd like to just read a passage that sort of describes this passage of movement, if that's okay.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, would you mind saying the name of where that's from?
It's actually from a manuscript, a book manuscript that I haven't published yet.
Oh, okay. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
Yeah. At the time, the first hydro engineers went to work on the tributaries of the Saguenay in the 1940s. The entire Innu population was engaged in hunting and trapping, spending 11 months of the year in the country, as they say. After a month of rest on the coast, Innu families began their 11-month-long journey to the height of land and back. From Sept-Îles, they paddled and poled their canoes up the Moisey and the St. Marguerite. From Pointe Bleue, they paddled the Peribonka and made their way around the month-long portage at Passe Dangereuse. Others climbed the Mingan or the Romain or the Mishtashipu. Their laden wood canvas canoes creaked as they pushed off as the nights and days grew cooler and the flies and mosquitoes ceased to be a menace. They paddled the eddy currents and ferried from shore to shore across the powerful current, using their poles in the shallows. When the birches began to rise up like flames among the dark evergreens and the scarlet foliage of the heath spilled over the treeless hills, they gorged on berries and shot grouse, which were everywhere, and followed the salmon to the pools below the big rapids. They had to paddle the portage lakes and climb the footpaths around the great falls on the St. Marguerite, the Romaine, or the Mishtashipu, taking off their slippery moccasins in the drenching rain, climbing up with their children on their backs, and then again with their loads of flour, their canoes, and all their gear. They patched the tears in their canvas canoes with spruce gum or lard, and when they wrung out their waterlogged boots or listened to the rain hissing on their stovepipes during the nights, they welcomed the coming of winter when the ice and dry snow would cover everything. As they traveled, they stopped for quick boil-ups to drink tea and to smoke their pipes, which helped to curb their hunger. And in the evening, once they had gathered the boughs for their carpets and the firewood was cut and stacked and the snares were set, they baked bannock and boiled meat, if they had some, in cast iron pots on their tin box stoves, the small children asleep on feather mattresses beside them. By November, when the ice was forming on the rivers, they would watch the ice pans and the river slob churning in the narrow open channel until it, too, froze over. By midwinter, their provisions were running low, and they would have to rely on their divinations and their prowess and their luck in finding the caribou and the white ptarmigan in the willows to avoid starvation. They stopped in the deep snow to check their traps, hoping the mice had not nibbled at the pelts if they were lucky to have caught something. And when finally they came crashing down the swollen rivers in early summer, their canoes now laden with pelts rather than flour sacks. By the time they arrived at Sept-Îles or Cheju or Equanchit, they had traveled 1,000 miles or more.
Awesome. Thank you for that.
So that was the, you know, the patterns of life that was, you know, came to an abrupt end with the mm-hmm. dams. First, the Innu who traveled the Peribonka rivers, and then the Manicouagan River and the Bestie Mitz River and the St. Marguerite. All of that came to abrupt, it became impossible once the rivers were dammed. And so then you had kind of enforced idleness and a system of welfare colonialism that was extremely degrading, as you can imagine. The once proud and independent Innu people.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's so sad.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing.
Yeah. Yeah. In your article, The Two Gorges, A River Journey, I remember the one part where you just wrote like how Hydro-Québec completely flooded the Innu land without their consent, and that is just so disgusting. I was wondering, where did the Innu people, where were they forced to go after that? Like, where did they live?
So that essay was about the Churchill Falls project, mm-hmm. and that was not actually built by Hydro-Québec. It was built by Newfoundland, but it was Hydro-Québec built the power lines and essentially gets to buy all the power from it. Mm-hmm. So it's essentially Hydro-Québec that it profited from that dam.
Okay.
So you are right to be talking about Hydro-Québec in that context as well. So, it was this pattern of movement. And so that was one of the, it's still to this day is one of the largest dam projects in the world. I mean, that Churchill Falls, I mean, it's kind of shocking that nobody's ever even heard of it. It was built in this very remote location, far from any markets, which is why they had to sell all the power to Hydro-Québec, because they had the mm-hmm. transmission lines and able to carry that power over hundreds of miles to get it to markets in the cities in Montreal and then down into, you know, exporting it to the United States. So the Inuit at the time were still very much, you know, living this way of life. If they traveled the, they called it the Grand River. They called it actually Mishtak-Jipu, which means our great river. So they traveled that. And the flooding that was created by that project, they created a lake that's rivals in size the Great Lakes. It's half the size of Lake Ontario. So it's just absolutely massive. So the disruption of having the heart of their homeland was now this impassable, just, you know, and in those days when reservoirs were created, they just flooded. They didn't make any attempt to sort of clear out the vegetation, to cut the trees. So it's just this vast swamp with all these dead trees and sort of rotting vegetation and mercury contamination. And because it's such a vast open water, and there was, it was just laced with all these, you know, these dead trees floating around. They could no longer, they couldn't travel across it. Much of the river is diverted so that it's dried out, so they can't travel anymore. They can't fish because of the contamination, the mercury contamination. So, you know, and at the time there was that was built, it was not even acknowledged by Newfoundland that the Innu even existed. They were just completely ignored.
Wow.
And, you know, and they had the audacity to announce that, you know, here was a project that had absolutely had no negative impacts on anybody. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that the Innu had left their canoes and their caches and their equipment, not even knowing that the flooding was going to happen. So they, all of their equipment was lost to the deluge. Wow. They'd received no compensation until recently. I mean, finally, they have been, they've received compensation, you know, and that was negotiated over getting them to agree to the Muskrat Falls project. So the same thing happened with the Hydro-Québec projects starting in the 40s and the 50s. And, well, Hydro-Québec didn't exist in the 40s, but didn't exist until the late 60s. But all those projects were also the same thing. The Manicouagan is one of the largest dams in the world to this day. It was built without, the Innu were given $150 each in compensation for that.
That's awesome.
And it completely ended their way of life. They lived primarily, their livelihood came from the fur trade, from trapping, and then subsistence hunting, and all of that came to an end.
Yeah.
So it had huge impacts, and they, to this day, have still not been compensated for that.
Wow.
And what I feel qualified to talk about really is how these projects are, you know, impacting people. And so when it gets into, I'm not an expert on their culture or the social problems that they have, but the way they describe is that what happened to them, and it's not just the dam projects, it's the dam projects in concert with these policies of compulsory schooling and welfare colonialism, all of that, and the kind of schooling that was kind of brainwashing them into, you know, giving up their language and their way of thinking, all of this is happening at the same time. They often, you know, hearing, for instance, Francis Panachouet talking about his personal, you know, transition was that, you know, all of a sudden he had nothing to do. And so he turned to alcohol, to drinking, and that became a big problem. And eventually he was able to overcome, you know, to go become sober. And he became one of the Innu elders who really was committed to resisting these projects and to, you know, for the sovereignty of the Innu people and land rights. And so I think that, you know, there was this First Nations sovereignty movement was taking place all across Canada. You know, it's sort of their, the period of their civil rights movement. It sort of started in the late 60s and it continued, you know, through the 90s, and it had an immense, you know, impact. And so the policies, there's been a huge sea change in sort of how governments, you know, interact with the First Nations now. And, you know, you can't just move in and just flood the lands of Indigenous people now the way they did in the 70s.
Yeah.
So I guess to how that links to your question is more that they're, you know, getting involved in the sort of movement for bringing back cultural practices and the fight for sovereignty and land rights and resisting these projects became a way of kind of pulling themselves out of this sort of degrading, what they called social collapse. I mean, it was complete culture and social collapse. And that's how the social problems involved in these communities that had, you know, very high suicide rates, poor infrastructure, poor healthcare, all of that.
Yeah, we would love to somehow reach out to them, to talk to them on this podcast too, if that's something that we could do.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that. Kind of to go off that, was there any training that you had to go through to work with the Innu community, or was it?
That would have been nice. Yeah, no, I mean, I, you know, other than the civil disobedience training for going up there for the, you know, I was a participant in a major protest that the Innu, you know, had asked us, you know, for supporters to come, and our role being really as witnesses, because there had been, you know, a lot of violence against, you know, the Innu around this SM3 project. There had been one incidence where the, you know, white mob had come and sort of surrounded this community, and they're wielding baseball bats. And so, you know, because of that, there was tremendous concern that there needed to be, if the Innu were going to have a protest, that there were going to be witnesses and there were going to be people there to try to prevent that violence from happening, as well as to witness the way in which the police were going to treat them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we did do the civil disobedience training. We formed a support group for the Innu. And so it started with the SM3 project and that protest. And then it wasn't just the SM3 project that the Innu were dealing with. There were all these other industrial intrusions. There was the Churchill Falls project, the second phase of it, which was just announced. There was the major minerals discovery at a place called Voisey's Bay, which was also a huge threat to them. There was logging, there was road building, there was military overflights that had been, the Innu had campaigned against that for, you know, for over a decade. So there were all these different campaigns. And so our support group was just trying to find ways to kind of amplify so that people could know in the outside world what was going on. And since primarily it is the, you know, it is the pressure coming from the consuming societies that are, you know, really the root cause of all this pressure on these communities, that it really was, you know, important that to raise awareness here in our country and in our communities about where our resources are coming from and the, you know, especially energy.
So kind of building off of that, how did you build a trusting relationship with the Innu community once you entered?
Well, it was, you know, it was because we were invited.
Oh.
So that's, you know, that's key, because we were only there. We didn't just show up. We were asked to come. And so we were really following the direction of the Innu leadership there. Then in later trips that I made to other communities, Innu communities, it was almost always at the invitation of one woman in particular, her name being Elizabeth Panashue, who was a very important elder and leader in these campaigns, and who was really, really standing up for the preservation of the Innu way of life and the protection of the rivers and the land. So I was, you know, mostly there at her invitation and because I was with her. So that became a very strong relationship. Mm. And she was somebody who really did reach out to supporters, and she invited supporters to come and stay with her. And she spent a lot of time with us, sort of teaching us and talking to us about, you know, their issues and their way of life. So I think that, you know, was just the trust that came from that relationship with a trusted elder. But at the same time, you know, there was still, you know, even with that sort of having a trusted elder sort of vouching for you, you know, there was still a lot of tension and there's a lot of suspicion and, you know, that I just could sense from people who didn't know me.
Yeah. How did you deal with that, if that's okay to ask?
Well, I could tell you a couple of stories where some sort of tense moments. One of them was when we were on that river trip, and it was Elizabeth Panashwin and her husband, and then also her sister and her husband, who were the four elders who took us down the river. And I sensed tension coming from the brother-in-law, who only spoke the Innu language. So Francis and Elizabeth both spoke English. So there was always just the language barrier. So there was this sort of reliance on translation. Yeah. So that, you know, that can definitely create tension, and you're never quite sure what you're communicating. But there was, you know, we were there with our cameras. I mean, we were there to document the river so that we could work on supporting the Innu in trying to defend the river. And we felt that kind of tangible experience of the place was so important into communicating to the outside world that, you know, if you build this dam, this is what is going to be destroyed. So we had our cameras and we're taking a lot of pictures. And every night when after we'd put the tents up and we'd, you know, have our dinner, and then we would pull out our journals and we'd be furiously writing away. So there was one time where I was sitting in a tent with two of the elders, and two of us were just writing away in our journals. And then I felt all this tension coming. And then somebody translated for us that this elder was feeling uncomfortable and wanted to know what we were writing in our journals. And I was kind of stunned by this. But then, you know, I did occur to me, you know, it was a illuminating moment after I thought about it, you know, that, you know, how they must feel that here we are taking all these pictures and furiously writing away in our journals in a language that they can't read. And I thought about too that what those elders grew up in an oral culture. Mm-hmm. They did not grow up in a book-based culture. They did not go to the residential schools and learn to read. So for them, the introduction of writing is associated with compulsory schooling and all the trauma, you know, something that hadn't occurred to me to think about. So there are subtle things that you just learn. A mistake to go into an Indigenous culture with assumptions of commonality, that you have more in common, that you care about the land, you want to protect the rivers, you have these ecologically based values, and you feel like there's this kinship and commonality, when really you're really coming from vast different worlds.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to keep that in mind and to not make some assumptions about that kinship.
Exactly. I remember in the presentation you gave to our class, you said, like, white people, we can have, like, strong values with the environment, but we will never really truly, like, feel and understand that connection that Indigenous people have with nature, just because that's their culture, that's everything that they're based on. And that was really, really moving for me. So thank you for saying that again. That was super important. Kind of to go off topic, kind of the same thing in your article, where there is light, there is water. You talked about your mother's death. And I thought that was really interesting to bring up in relation to your work. So how did your mother's death affect your work in these communities?
Well, it was the timing of it, that when I did get first involved, I had just, you know, just come out of this period of deep mourning. It was a difficult, prolonged, terrible experience of her hospitalization, and it was a kind of situation where kind of the medical industrial machine kind of took over, and that's kind of the way Western medicine, you know, unfortunately tends to work. And so, you know, I came out of that, moved to Vermont and spent a winter of sort of a period of, you know, solitude and writing poetry and sort of intense, like, you know, inward quiet period. And then kind of came out of this with this, this period of grieving. I think I was really ready for finding something meaningful and the maybe the deeper sense of empathy and the value that I learned to place on the living world and life. And, you know, I think that was all related to how I got involved in this work.
Yeah.
I did think I would become an activist in the right to die issue, but it ended up being much more about, you know, defending life on the planet than issues around death with dignity.
Yeah. I remember in your piece you talked a little bit about control and tying it into like control of people and control of the environment. That was such a great connection. I just wanted to mention that.
Thinking about sort of the metaphor of, you know, my mother was hooked up to these machines for a period of a few months, you know, and they were just kind of keeping her, you know, alive. And so to think of that as sort of a metaphor of a harnessed river, or you could even think about that as a metaphor, sort of what we're doing at this point at this moment with industrial civilization, and how we know we're sort of at a terminus point, but yet we continue to think that we just have to keep it going, mm-hmm. right? We got to find a way to sort of keep the planet on life support is sort of what we're doing right now.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah, that reminds me of the planetary boundaries framework, how like these are the limits that we can push, but why do we need to push them? You know, like there's no need to do that.
Yeah, asking the questions about why and what's it all for? So we're sort of right now in this frenzy about trying to find new energy sources, and yet we're not asking the question, what do we want to use energy for? You know, what is the aim? Like, if we're going to completely rebuild our energy infrastructure, do we really want to continue our car dependency, or do we want to take this as an opportunity to re-envision what is the best way to organize human life? Is it really around car ownership?
Yeah, that's exactly what we're talking about in our sustainable transportation class. So that's great that you mentioned that. Thank you.
Yeah.
So yeah, just perfect. To go off a little bit, we have been talking a lot in our class about how our life is so centered around the automobile, how we're basically like building cities around it and just like developing life around it. But that's not really the way that life should be lived. So yeah, I don't know. We're exploring a little bit about other alternative solutions, and it's really inspiring.
Yeah. So I'm a little bit frustrated with the emphasis on electric cars and, you know, this moving everything towards electricity, because we really have not solved the problem of producing electricity, obviously.
Yeah.
So why are we thinking that we've solved the problem if we've switched everything over to electricity? We really don't have good ways of making electricity. You know, wind and solar is just a tiny sliver of the pie. And, you know, if we're going to make a push towards using more electricity, that electricity is going to come from more dams. It's going to come from all these bad sources. So, you know, but again, you know, there's ways that we can, you know, if, you know, the claim is that the emissions, you know, the carbon impact of driving electric vehicles is about half of what it is to drive a internal combustion engine car. So what other ways could we achieve that 50% reduction? Well, take a passenger, or, you know, leave your car at home. So, I mean, in Vermont, we don't really have the bus as an option, but, you know, there's all this, I'm just afraid that all the money towards this transition, because the electric vehicles is such an expensive, mm-hmm. you know, the car dependency is such an incredibly expensive way to live, that we're going to put all the resources into that. And it's not going to get us where we need to go, you know, it's not going to get us to our goals. 50% is not enough, you know, even if it is that. So, you know, I'd like to see more conversation about thinking about how we can, you know, change our patterns of living, how we can think more about ways to share resources and car share and ride share and leaving our car at home and, you know, finding ways to localize our economy more so that we're not traveling as much. Those are all, I think, more sustainable solutions. So we, you know, if your goal is 50% reduction in your carbon emissions impact, then you can achieve that without spending $50,000 on an electric car and without having to put in all this expensive infrastructure just by taking a passenger along or car sharing with somebody. There you go. It doesn't cost you a penny to do that. And you could do it tomorrow. You could do it today.
I also have issues with electric cars because they are just so inaccessible to middle to low income communities. Like, they just can't afford them even with incentives. Yeah. I'll never be able to afford one. But I think Vermont, like you said, needs to put more emphasis on car share. We need to increase our bus routes. Like, we are a rural state, so I understand that it's hard to do that. But if they want to reduce our emissions, that's the way to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To speak a little bit on the note of hope, though, Green Mountain Transit did this past winter release a rideshare program in Montpelier. And it basically works like Uber. You get an app on your phone and then have someone come pick you up, exactly similar to Uber, but it's free, at least for the time of COVID. And it's doing really well right now. So
that's
one thing that we are doing.
Yeah, that's excellent. And it doesn't require, you know, trillions of dollars of subsidies to do that. All you need is an app, right? It's excellent. Yeah, I'd like to see more kinds of thinking like that. You know, because we really need to act quickly. You know, we only have a few years. So we need to think about the steps that we can take, that we can do right away, you know, without having to involve a lot of fossil fuel use and building all this, because we have to realize that building all this new infrastructure is going to involve using fossil fuels. So we need to try to find ways that we can, you know, reduce our impact quickly, like right now, without investing more in fossil fuel use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Thank you for that insight.
Yeah, awesome. Kind of to go off of that later in the outline that we have, do you think there are any policies that hydro companies specifically, just because we're talking about hydropower, can adopt to make the practice more sustainable and conscious, more sustainable and ethical?
Well, that's where the greenwashing comes in, you know, because they really claim that, you know, well, they're you know, they've really reformed and they, you know, are environmentally sensitive now. And it's true, there is a difference. They do all these studies. You know, when the Churchill Falls Dam was built, they didn't do any studies. They didn't do any environmental, they didn't do any assessment of like what the social impacts or environmental impacts would be. They just went in with the bulldozers and they just flooded the land. So now they do all these studies, but how is that different? Because you can't mitigate. Their ideas about mitigation for mercury contamination is to print pamphlets alerting the local communities that it's not safe to eat the fish. Now that's their idea of mitigation, because you really can't mitigate mercury contamination. The other mitigation is fish ladders, which for salmon, they just do not work. And we have 100 years of experience to know that it doesn't work.
Sorry, can you explain what a fish ladder is?
You know, when you build a dam on a river, you create a barrier so the fish can't pass. Fish ladders are built for the salmon, but they're built for their upstream journey to help them, you know, climb back up when they go upriver. But that doesn't help the salmon in their downstream journey. They need that current, you know, and they get banged up in the turbines anyway. So the fish ladders, you know, may help to save a few fish, but they really do very little. You know, there isn't mitigation. So the other mitigation that Hydro-Québec now boasts about is this idea of no net loss. In other words, recognizing that you build a dam, you're going to destroy some pieces of, you know, nature, but you're going to balance that out by protecting some other area. So that's all they have for mitigation: fish ladders, pamphlets, and this idea of no net lost. So the answer is really you can't build a massive hydro dam with, you know, you build them small. First of all, don't build any more. You know, we need make the best use out of the electricity, the most equitable use, try to repair some of the damage to the indigenous communities, address the, compensate those who haven't been compensated. You can do a much better job of mitigation in that sense. And you can just stop building any new dams and use that energy in a better way, in a more efficient way, and make use of it.
I just have a quick question. Are those pamphlets that you said about the mercury contamination, are those in English or are they in the indigenous language? Do you remember?
That's a good question. Yeah, I would think that they would at least be printing them in the new language. They probably are. You can see on the when we went down the Churchill River, there's a big sign at one point, and it's a warning about mercury contamination. And it is written in four different languages. Okay. It's English, French, Inuit, and Innu language. You know, but they, you know, and they also, they, Hydro-Québec offered to also, you know, sample, test the, you know, the Innu found that very insulting. Like, you're going to give us pamphlets and then you're going to monitor us like we're subjects in some kind of experiment to see, like, how much, you know, we're being poisoned. And they found that very insulting.
Yeah, I bet. I can totally understand where that's coming from.
Yeah.
Do you see any renewable energies that don't harm Indigenous rights?
Well, I don't think it's, you know, some forms versus others. It's that, you know, we need renewable energies, that's for sure. But I think we have to coordinate that the, you know, because all forms of energy have impacts, right? So we have to make sure that the people who are benefiting from the impacts are also the ones who are bearing the cost. So right now, what we have is that we get here in Vermont, get to the benefits of this energy, and we get to claim that we have this clean, you know, that the energy we're using is carbon-free and all that, which is what we claim about it. We get to use it and benefit, but yet it's somebody else who pays the costs.
Yeah.
And so I think what a sustainable system looks like is one that's equitable in the sense that the, you know, if we want to, in our community here in Richmond, we decide we want to put a wind turbine up on our Robin Mountain there. Maybe that's something that we have to decide if that sacrifice of that mountaintop, weighing the costs and benefits, they're shared by the same people. The people who benefit are also the ones who pay the cost of it. So that's what a sustainable future would look like. It also has to be, we have to talk about how much energy we use. It's not just about the forms of energy we use, because there can't be sustainable renewable energy if we're just going to continue to find newer and more ways to use more and more energy. And that's what we're doing, because, you know, if you look at cryptocurrencies, for instance, which is a really intensive use of electricity, mm-hmm. that technology requires. And just Bitcoins alone has wiped out all the gains we've made worldwide with solar energy. So it doesn't matter how many solar panels we build if we're going to start doing things like Bitcoins, which is going to wipe out all the gains. And then we're going to need to, we're not going to reduce our fossil fuel use by building out solar and wind, unless we're making sure that we're actually replacing the fossil fuels. We're using wind power instead of fossil fuels, instead of just in addition to. Right. Because that's what's happening, is that with all the great gains that we're making in wind and solar, we're still not reducing our fossil fuel consumption. We're just adding more energy into the mix.
Yeah, like with carbon credits, I have so much grief with carbon credits. Like, why? It just doesn't make sense because you like the people who buy carbon credits are using fossil fuels, and then they're saying like, oh, well, we're offsetting it, but you're still polluting. Yeah. Like, it's just not, it's not the same. I just have big issues with it. But yeah, that was a great answer. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Kind of. So we looked at the company part, and now for like what we can do as people who perpetuate these companies who displace Indigenous people from their lands, what can we do to reject this unjust industry? Because, you know, people do buy power from like Burlington Electric Department, and that's hydropower, some of it, and people sometimes don't know. So what can we do to stop buying into it?
Well, we have to just start with being honest about where our electricity is coming from.
Yeah.
You know, you go to, you know, I had a big problem with the movement for the carbon tax bill in Vermont a couple of years ago with the literature that they're putting out and saying that, you know, we're going to move to electricity because electricity is local. And there was nothing, you know, in their literature that was actually admitting that our electricity is not local. And right now we're at about 50% of our electricity in Vermont is coming from Hydro-Quebec. So let's start with just being honest about where our electricity is coming from and what its impacts are. And so once we start with, you know, recognizing that, you know, electricity is dirty too.
Yeah.
And electricity has problems and limits. I mean, you know, just because of course the sun and the wind are infinite, yes, and water runs, you know, and it's renews itself, whatever, but that doesn't mean, you know, that's just not to understand the laws of physics, which is that it doesn't matter that there's an infinite amount of sunlight. It's that we have to concentrate it in order to concentrate it to make it useful for mechanical work.
Yeah.
You have to use non-renewable materials. You have to use steel and concrete and copper and lithium and all these things. And those are all finite and they're limited. So I think we should stop using the word renewable, actually.
Yeah.
I think it's misused. I mean, I heard just a couple of days ago on the radio something about renewable natural gas. Does anybody know what that is?
I can't say I do now.
Okay. Well, you know, the renewable hydropower is renewable, but you've eliminated forests that are never going to grow back. You've, you know, put a big, huge concrete and steel structure in the middle of the river that's not going to last forever.
But you're saying the gas, or they're saying the gas is renewable.
Well, yeah, that's what they're calling it, renewable natural gas. I haven't looked up yet exactly what they mean by that, but that seems like an oxymoron.
Yeah.
Renewable natural gas. Yeah. I'm just saying that we, you know, we need to be careful with how that language is used and what does it really mean?
So for any people looking to go into this field, do you have any advice or closing words you can leave us with?
I'd like to read you one quote.
Yeah, please.
From I did an interview with a leader, an Innu Nation leader, this is back in the mid-90s, the late Daniel Sheeney. And I was asked him just generally how we could support the Innu. And this was his answer. He said, the kind of support we need is to get to the root cause of the problems with the Innu people. And the root cause is very clear. It's a society that wants more and more every day. They want more economic development. They want more zeros behind that number in front of their pocketbooks and bank books. We ourselves don't need help. We are doing ourselves what we feel is right. In our communities, we're trying to deal with the problems that are continuously being forced down our throats by the white society. It's that the society that needs help, not us. So just, you know, that really getting at the root causes, and really we need to change ourselves. That's the best way that we can support Indigenous societies.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. That was an inspiring quote.
Yeah, is that also from your manuscript that hasn't been published yet?
Yes.
Okay, I will definitely want to look for that when it comes.
Yes, out. I think I've put that quote in some of the published. I'll find it for you and send it to you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for spending this time with us. Do you have any last words you want to throw in here before we stop recording?
I didn't talk about sustainable agriculture, but for me, I think that's really the key.
Okay.
Oh, all right.
It really means, you know, reorganizing our economy around, you know, localizing it and organizing it around patterns that are compatible with the idea of renewability, which is that, you know, societies that were based upon renewable energy sources were also in tune with cycles of seasons and day and night and life and death and growth and decay. And so we're involved in this fantasy that we can somehow have this way of life that was built on non-renewable energy systems that we could just, you know, plug in, you know, turn on the tap whenever we want without accepting that there will be periods of abundance and other periods of scarcity and times when we can use energy and times when we can't. So I think that part of the reason why I think sustainable agriculture is the key is that we will start to retune our patterns of living in terms of, you know, what renewability really means, which is that being in tune with the patterns of nature herself.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm in a permaculture class right now, and I kind of have to just, for our final project, like create a design for about an acre field of just like permaculture principles. And that's so interesting that you say that, because like permaculture, do you know anything about permaculture?
Yes.
Yeah, I love how they like really emphasize native plants and the practices, because those plants are conditioned for the conditions in whatever area. And they also really emphasize perennial plants too. So it's like self-renewing. So that's, I'm really glad you brought that up. That is super important. Like the more I learn about it, the more I'm really interested in it.
And I also see that transition is something that we know how to do it. We know how to farm sustainably. And it's something that we could do it tomorrow. We could just start doing that. And we don't need to sort of, it's not a moonshot, right? You know, it's something that we know how to do and we can do it. And we can start freeing up a lot of the land that's being used for growing grains to feed cattle. We can use that to plant trees.
Right. Yeah, it's, you know, definitely a place to start.
We need to make the planet resilient. So again, we're thinking about not just like changing our technology, but we're also fixing problems that will have other benefits, like, you know, that we have healthier communities, we will have healthier bodies, we'll have cleaner water. So we will be solving a lot of problems at once, not just the carbon problem.
Yeah, I feel like that's just the issue with huge companies like Hydro-Québec and like huge agricultural companies. They only care about the profit, and it's just so disgusting and really dehumanizing.
Yeah, and the impact, you know, the carbon, the greenhouse gas impact, the climate impact of industrial agriculture is a huge piece of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on electric vehicles, and, you know, I think we start to, you know, it's sucking up all the oxygen. There's all these other areas where I think immense, you know, progress could be made, you know, and quickly.
I just read an article, sorry, I keep going on. I like love this conversation. I just read an article for my sustainability science class too that they looked at the life cycle analysis of electric vehicles, and even like less than half of the time, electric vehicles are better than internal combustion. Like they're really not as good as internal combustion vehicles, and it's not because of the electricity, it's because of the manufacturing in it. Like the manufacturing of the parts of the vehicle are just so hazardous to human and environmental health. Really? I thought that was really interesting. Yeah,
the waste problem that those batteries are going to create is going to be enormous. Again, we're not thinking ahead. We're not looking forward to that problem. It's just the same thing we did when we built nuclear power plants, not thinking about, okay, we're going to create this huge waste problem and we don't have a solution. And so we're making the same mistake with electric vehicles. We're not thinking about what are we going to do, because those, you know, batteries are not going to get recycled and they're extremely hazardous as waste. So we better be thinking ahead about that problem if we're going to start, we're going to have this major rollout of electric vehicles.
Yeah, plus what the electric vehicles are powered with, like it has to be, I don't want to use the word renewable because you said you don't like the word.
Yeah, a sustainably sourced.
Clean and ethical energy, how about that, yeah.
All right. So again, that was Alexis Latham, and we're going to link two of her articles in the description of this podcast. Thank you, Alexis, so much again for coming on today and talking to us a little bit about your work. That was so inspiring, and we really appreciate it. And thank you to all of our listeners, and tune in next week.
Yeah, so like Rachel said, thank you again, Alexis. It was such a privilege, such an honor to have you on, and we hope for upcoming episodes we can reach out to the Innu community or the Indigenous Environmental Network and talk with them about their personal experiences. But for next week, I'm going to have on Laura Jacoby from Old Spokes Home, who does equity work in biking and bikeability, which is really interesting. So yeah, just stay tuned for that. Thank you again for listening, and hope you all have a great day.